Hello, and welcome back to another installment of EP Architalk, the official podcast of the AIA New York State Emerging Professionals. Just a reminder to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcast and leave us a review. Today, we have the 42nd District Assemblywoman, Rodnice Bichot-Hermelin, and Nicoba Noma President-elect, Allison Lane. Thank you again for joining us today as we continue to celebrate Black History Month. It's a pleasure to speak with you both about Black leadership and success. So let's jump right in and start with a little bit of each of your backgrounds. Rodnice, why don't we start with you? Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about your background story and how you came to be the assemblywoman?
Thank you so much, Talisha, for having me on ArchiTalk podcast. It's really exciting to be here today on your show. I want to also welcome Allison for being here. I want to congratulate you on becoming the first Black president of the Brooklyn Architect Organization, Talisha.
So thank you. Thank you. Bravo to you. Thank you.
So as a quick introduction for the audience, my name is Rodnice Bichot-Hermelin. I am the assembly member of the 42nd Assembly District, which is the most central part of Brooklyn, Flatbush, East Flatbush, Midwood, Dittmas Park. And I am also the chair of the Brooklyn Democratic Party, a non-paid thankless job, but could be very fulfilling. But I have to say, this wasn't always the case in terms of having a traditional path in being in those roles. I am the first Black person to hold the assembly seat in my assembly district. And I am also the first woman to run the Brooklyn Democratic Party. So there's a number of firsts here. I did take somewhat of an untraditional path to get here. As some of you may know, I had a number of different careers. I started off as a math teacher and then went into technical engineering, where I worked with Lucent Technologies and worked in Japan and China. Because I enjoyed the analytical fields, I decided to get my master's in electrical engineering as well, and then decided to continue on a different route. I went to school at night at Northwestern to get my MBA, which really led the path for me to kind of distance myself away from like the math and science and go into like another analytical field, which is Wall Street investment banking. So in each of these roles, you can see there weren't many women who served as students or served as colleagues, whether it was in the engineering, whether it was in mathematics when I was a public school math teacher, or whether it was in investment banking. There were not a lot of women in the field, as mentioned, and there were even fewer Black women. In fact, this day, Black women make up just over 1% of the field. But Black women innovators continue to solve many of our greatest challenges. And I serve in many positions. Black women were underrepresented. I have to say that after doing a little bit of investment banking, because I know there was disparities in terms of representation, I decided to work on a number of campaigns. One of the campaigns that I worked on when I was in Chicago was Senator Barack Obama's campaign when he was senator. He was a state senator then, and he was running for U.S. Senate. And I joined his campaign. I joined the Democratic Party out in Illinois. And then fast forward, he won. I left Chicago, came to New York, did the Wall Street thing, didn't like it, helped a local senator by the name of Senator Kevin Parker in his campaign, which was a really tough campaign. And that's when I said, I can be part of that. And so fast forward in 2010, I decided to run for a political party, non-paid position called district leader, which was very, very contentious. I ran against two people. Two other women, I won. And then from then on, I ran for the assembly, lost, ran again for the assembly, won. And when I ran for the assembly, I decided to take on roles like the Minority Women Business Enterprise Subcommittee Chair, which for me was dedicated to economic justice. And as you know, I work with a lot of contractors, small business owners, architects who are in a field where sometimes they don't get their fair share. And I have participated and partnered with a lot of the stakeholders in bringing on legislation that will bring more opportunities, mentorship, capital resources, and just making government contracting more available to the people in the field. So I'll stop here.
I mean, that's still a lot to stop at. So imagine there's still like 12 more years to go. That's an amazing story. Thank you for sharing. Allison, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background? You can stop at the same point when Rodney's won.
Sure. I guess I'll stop when I got my license or shortly thereafter.
Stop wherever you want.
Thank you so much for hosting us. It's a pleasure to be here with you both. And, you know, just reading a little bit about you, Rodney's, and getting to have this conversation with you here today, you know, to learn even more. I'm definitely inspired. And as Black women in general, you know, seeking to just move forward in our careers, but also, you know, reach back and help others, you know, through our various journeys, I already see like 5 different commonalities. And it's just wonderful to be here. A little bit about myself. I'm Allison Lane, and I am a licensed architect and project manager currently working at AECOM in New York. I'm also, as Talisha mentioned, the current president-elect for NYCOBA NOMA, which is the New York chapter of the National Organization of Minority Architects, of which our chapter grew out of the original New York Coalition of Black Architects, hence our combined acronym, NYCOBA NOMA. I have 12 years in counting experience in the industry, working on a diverse array of project types from single family residential to high-rise residential buildings, as well as commercial, institutional, industrial, and even some transportation projects. So similar to Rodney's story, I think one of our commonalities is that we value a diversity of experiences, which only continue to add and develop into who we are, you know, as we continue to grow in our careers and professions. And then reaching back a little bit in terms of what made me choose architecture as a career path. Growing up, I was always creative from visual arts as well as even performance arts, you know, participating in choir, playing the flute, piccolo, things like that. And also really just constantly drawing, painting, and sketching with my mother as an educator and my father's background in construction and real estate. My parents really encouraged me to consider looking toward a career in architecture from a fairly early age. I was very intrigued by the process of designing a building and having it materialize into, you know, a tangible, you know, real structure. Additionally, the opportunity to really positively impact lives of communities through the built environment made architecture and its many interrelated disciplines of urban development, sustainability, and so on an easy choice for me to pursue. And as a Black female architect, the ability to affect change is really important to me. You know, again, I'm thankful to be on the platform and share my story with others.
Quite the background. And I never knew that you played flute and piccolo.
Yeah.
I don't think that I can tell the difference between the two sounds. So
yeah, the piccolo is a higher pitch, but it's still the same on keys and, you know, ways of performing on the instrument.
Okay. All right.
One's just larger than the other. Piccolo is very small, hence the high pitch.
Okay. I have to say, I was very impressed with your background. And when we talk about music, just so you know, we do have a commonality there as well. I went to the School of Performing Arts and I studied music, but it was vocal music. I have lost everything. Like, I don't know anything anymore. But I did come from a family of musicians. My father was a famous jazz musician. He played the saxophone, he played the piano, he played the organ, he played the clarinet. And he also instructed and coached opera.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
But I didn't retain any of that.
What about you, Allison? Did either one of your parents have a musical background?
My mother, definitely. She is the singer. You know, I mentioned, you know, that I'm in choir and I used to sing, you know, on a more consistent basis. And everyone would always ask me, you know, do I sound like my mother? The answer is no. She has. That higher operatic soprano, you know, voice and octave. I'm a little more mezzo / alto. And then going back, really just, you know, my maternal side is absolutely a musical family. Both of my parents have really strong Southern roots, you know, which I'm a part of as well. But, you know, back to my extended family and my ancestors, they're really known for, you know, singers and going throughout various ministries and churches in the South throughout, you know, the history of Baptist song conventions and all of that. They were highly active in that arena.
Wow. I wonder if there's a correlation between all of your accomplishments for both of you and having that sort of musical background, which I don't have, which is why I'm not as accomplished as you two are.
Oh my gosh.
I think we are all accomplished in our own ways and own rights. I do think there is a correlation because they always say the sciences, because the architect is in the sciences. They say the sciences and music go hand in hand.
Well, thank you for saying that. You've brightened up my day and given me hope to reach up to the both of you when I grow up. But speaking of which, Rodney, you mentioned that you started off being a math teacher. You worked in finance. I know that you worked in engineering and you even spent some time in Japan. Do you know any Japanese still?
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because I have a lot of connections with different cultures. And I just remember that in the School of Performing Arts, LaGuardia, I was the first Black to join the Chinese club because I was really fascinated with Asian culture and history. And so when I was recruited to work in Japan and China, it was like, oh my God, this is like a dream come true. So I did take it upon myself to go to school at night to learn Japanese. So I did learn how to speak, write, read Japanese. Not too proficient, but enough to kind of walk around on my own. It was great to finally come to a point where I can have a conversation with someone in Japan. I remember having my braids and they would compliment me on my braids.
Yeah.
And we'd talk about my braids.
That's great.
And some people thought I was Whitney Houston or Mary J. Blige.
Not bad. Both of those, not bad to be mistaken for.
I wish I had you as a tour guide. I spent 2 weeks in Japan with a group of city planning students. I went during my master's in architecture at Pratt. So I just did, you know, the 2 week prior crash course to, you know, certain keywords and phrases in Japanese, definitely not as fluent as you were.
I lost everything. I already remember 5 phrases. So do you remember Ohayou gozaimasu?
Yes.
Okay. That's easy.
I also learned how to order plum wine because I love it. But
oh, really?
The important things.
We might want to cut that out. But
the important things.
You know, the Japanese culture is, you know, amazing from a design and city planning standpoint. And honestly, you know, as a New Yorker, I'm sure you all will appreciate just my experiences and, you know, how clean the city was. And that really goes back to their cultural appreciation for the environment and really adhering to a strict cultural protocol of respect for not only each other, but also nature, which I found really inspiring.
Yeah. One of the things I did remember was that in Japan, they use their space very efficiently. Very efficient. They don't waste space from the architect of their homes and even using public transportation. They were up to date in terms of technology. I remember back then in the 90s, that's when I went to Japan, they had cell stations. So it was a time where back in the 90s, you can use your cell phone. It took a while for New York or the United States to get to that point. I think we just implemented like base stations or cell sites in the train. So I thought that was fascinating. People in Japan are clean, very clean. Everything is clean. Everybody's respectful. And the work ethics is unmatched. I mean, I would work 12 hours. Can we take a break and very detail oriented? You know, if there was something, the code that was off, it's like, okay, we got to stop everything. We got to fix this one little thing because we want to make sure that we deploy a very seamless software to the cell site. So I agree, Allison. It was one of my best experiences in life, having to learn the business protocols And architect is huge over there. I mean, you know, engineering, architect, I mean, that's their thing. It's huge. And it was just great to have that experience.
That sounds amazing. And that's one of the places that I'd like to go sometime in my life. So knock on wood. Let me ask you, Rodney, what made you choose to go into engineering in the first place?
So English was a second language for me, even though I was born in the US because my parents spoke Haitian Creole. And I was struggling in school. I could have been lost, almost left back. I was in special need, special everything, okay? Special ed, everything. And I didn't know what to do with myself as a kid, to be honest. It took an incident that happened at the age of 10 where I got hit, almost died crossing the street. And then I was homebound, bedridden, and I was forced to get a home instructor who then had a one-on-one opportunity to be with me. And I was able to like catch up for meeting in math. And leaving the idea of becoming a gymnast or a dancer, I just kind of found myself focusing on school. And I find myself liking math. I find myself coding in junior high school. And it was just one of those things. So when I did go to college, I still didn't know what to do. But then there was an instructor, the first female engineering teacher, the Buffalo State College, pulled me in. She said, you know, I see you in this math program. I would like for you to give technology a chance. And so she gave me a chance. I did well in the program. I was the only female back then. This is in the 90s. And I did excel and I won scholarships. And that was encouraging. It was just encouraging to do well in something for once. So I think when you do well in something, it motivates you. I love numbers. I love problem solving. And it was just the way to go for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any correlation between that love of solving problems that you sort of use to transition you into public service? I know that you worked for Obama campaign and then Kevin Parker and you know, it gave you the spark. You know, is there any of that sort of you feel like is the same? How did you transition into the public service world?
So the public service sector was always in me. I started my first public work with the March of Dimes when I was in junior high school. And at the age of 12 and the age of 13, I was one of the top fundraisers, believe it or not. And so I was invited to Houston's party, personal party. And then the next year was Freddie Jackson's. So public service was with me since then, working for March of Dimes. After that, I had joined Habitat for Humanity at college, where I learned a lot about construction, hammering, things like that, and how we can incorporate the community to help people to get their first option to building wealth by owning a home and participating in investing their equity in building the home. So that was great. And I've been part of Habitat for like a good 20 years. And so it's just been ongoing. One of the things that I realized that when I was in Wall Street, I learned a lot from Wall Street. I learned quickness. I learned how to use spreadsheets. And those skills helped me win my race because even within politics, you need analytical skills and data to kind of assess who you're targeting. So I use all of those things. And I thought that that went hand in hand. But Wall Street also taught me that I'm not that person. You know, they would not let me go to church on Sundays. I had to work. I mean, it was just things like that. I'm like, this isn't me. I felt empty. So it kind of found myself again. And I realized that being a public servant is problem solving. People come to my office with any issue, and I have to find a way to solve it, even if they want me to capture the moon for them. And we found ways because sometimes it's just a matter of picking up the phone and calling someone who may know someone who can help and being able to work with different agencies, social service agencies, education, whatever. And also building a network of people in the industry, especially in the MWBE industry. I've been able to work, listen to people, create bills based on testimonies and people's hardship, turn them into opportunities, and help change the whole landscape for minority women to get more access. So I did see a correlation, and that's why I like politics, because you can make politics or government or whatever field you want to kind of put it in under, a thing to help people to solve problems. It doesn't have to be mundane. It could be different. You do different things every day. It's about bringing results and really making change. And Talisha, you've been with me. You've come to Albany. I've worked with AIA. I knew a lot of the issues that the architects had, a lot of burden, insurance, all of these things. And what I try to do as a partner to the industry is to try to navigate and see what are the barriers and how could we break them down and come up with a solution. A bill could change the lives of architects, you know, a small bill, it could change the whole thing.
It sure can.
So that's how I see it. It's a hand-in-hand thing. Problem solving in this field is definitely a big thing.
Do you feel like, I mean, congratulations to you on being the first Black woman from this assembly district to hold the seat and also being the first woman to hold the Brooklyn Democratic Party seat. That's not necessarily easy to do or easy to stick with.
Mm-hmm.
I know this.
Right. I get it twice every day.
How do you feel like you're being a woman of color, a Black woman, being in these two positions influence the way that you govern and the way that you make your decisions? Does it have any influence on what you're going to do into the future? I mean, it can be difficult. You know, I think we all three can agree that there are aspects of it that maybe we're not. Well, I'll speak for myself. Maybe I'm not as well equipped to tackle, but I have to do it, right? There goes that problem solving
right.
issue. So how do you feel?
It's very difficult. Being the assemblywoman, first Black, it was tough for some folks in my district to accept me because change takes time to accept, no matter who you are. And so I thought that was huge. Coming in with a focus on trying to kind of bring in equity, which is why I do a lot of work in the MWBE space, but equity also from a healthcare standpoint, which I'm a big proponent of universal healthcare, being represented in a very immigrant community with a lot of seniors and having to see people just not getting access and not having advocacy. Coming in and bringing my real life experiences in my everyday life and to change things, it was a little bit of a challenge, but it's doable. And certainly being the Democratic Party chair, that's very, very hard because you now become the talk of the town and the punching bag. And I'm always in the news, good and some bad things in terms of, you know, attacks, unnecessary attacks and so forth.
I see it.
Yeah, you see it, right. You know, it's just a seat. You know, I'm in there, oh, the machine, the boss. They call me the big boss, but I'm not a big boss. I'm not a boss, period. But my job is to bring a unified party of 1.2 million people. And sometimes you have the minority faction of the party that speaks louder on Twitter or whatever. But the vast majority of the party is not a reflection of the small handful of people who just complains and make things and stuff like that. So I have to try to keep that balance because we would not want, you know, that faction only representing them and no one representing people of color, no one representing women, no one representing immigrant communities, you know, more of the rural communities as well. So it's difficult. And it's difficult sometimes because a Black woman has to work 10 times harder than their male colleagues. Certainly my predecessors probably didn't have to go through half of the attacks that I go through, even from my own community, like colleagues, you know, Black colleagues or whatever. You have people who attack just to attack. And it's like you're always having to prove yourself, right? You're always having to prove yourself. So it's tough. I mean, but you know what it is? We're strong women. Mom left me last year.
Yeah, very sorry about that.
Almost a year ago. Yeah, thank you. And, you know, she told me, look, you have a job to do. You better do it and win, okay? And do it well. You are serving the people here. Just continue the fight and win because that's what our ancestors believe in. Our ancestors like Jean-Jacques Dessalines, who I am an heir to, that's the blood in us. Be resistant, resilient, and continue. And being Haitian American, as you know, Talisha, this is what we go through. We go through so many crises in our lives, in our history, in our country, in our community. But we have to find a way to keep moving on, even with all those crises and issues that we have to carry on our shoulders, the discriminatory practices, the ripping of resources, our country being raped of resources, being exploited, people here being discriminated, even sometimes amongst Black people,
right?
Because we're the boat people, we're the bottom of the barrel, and we speak a different language. I mean, it's all these different things that we have to find a way to navigate. And I think, you know, Black women has been very instrumental in carrying those weights, you know, our Sojourner Truth. I mean, you know, we can talk about all these Black women, and have been very influential in how our country is. We talk about Stacey Abrams, who was instrumental in changing the narrative in Georgia and voting rights. And so we have a role here, you know, even though I face challenges in these, you know, assembly chair, being Haitian American, all that stuff, we have a role. And our role is not to give up and throw in the towel.
Yeah, that's so really poignant. And my sincerest condolences for the loss of your mother. You know, yesterday I just went through the 1 year anniversary death of my maternal grandmother, you know, who passed away at 89.
I'm sorry to hear that, Allison.
My condolences.
Thank you. And it's tough, as I can only imagine, you know, losing your parent. You know, I'm always, you know, reminded of, you know, her story of adversity and struggles and overcoming those, you know, to really propel, you know, both my mother, you know, my aunts and uncles, but also myself. My grandmother, you know, she grew up in the South in a time where, you know, a lot of the resources that, you know, my ancestors did have, you know, were stripped away shortly after Reconstruction. And, you know, my grandmother, she had 12 children and previously worked as a domestic, but decided that she wanted something better for herself. So, you know, even after having 12 children, she decided to go back to school, become a licensed nurse, which really is a story that we all just cherish and use constantly for inspiration, even on my own architectural journey. You know, sometimes I get setbacks or I feel like I'm not, you know, as far as along as I should be. But, you know, I always think to the stories of on my own family history and, you know, other Black icons that we look up to, you know, just to continue to have that courage to move forward and, you know, also look to people that we have commonalities with as well as allies to create a support group, which is really a great part of the work that I do along with Talisha, with Nykoba Noma, you know, our group of Black architects and aspiring architects and designers, you know, really provides a space for us to, you know, discuss these very important issues and find ways to navigate them and join forces with other firms and leaders in the industry and also work with the AIA to make these barriers a lot more easier for, you know, people behind us to move past.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, to both of your points, I sort of feel like Black women especially represent a lot of resilience, as we can see here in this room today. I mean, so much resilience. It can sometimes be incredible and heartwarming to see. And Rodnice, you did say that you're not a boss, but I would say that you're definitely a leader. A boss might be a title, but a leader is a character trait.
Thank you.
In knowing you for over 10 years now.
We've gone way back. She was at the start of it. Talisha was at the start of it.
Phone banking.
Yes.
I definitely see the leadership and feel the leadership in the room today. So I thank you again for both of you being here. I wanted to know a little bit about how you feel like we can expand our reach to the youth, especially maybe in underserved communities, to share information about STEAM professions like architecture, how to get involved, you know, in your local neighborhood, even like with community boards. Start with your community boards or your district leader, you know? How do you feel like we can actually expand our reach? Allison, I'll start with you.
I think to expand our reach, there's a few ways that you can attack that objective. I think the first one is to, you know, for me as an architect, as a professional, you know, look to your local professional organizations. That's a great way to start. As you know, they often have outreach programs that includes NOMA, NESB. Yeah, definitely look to organizations such as NOMA, NESB, and you know, if you're a part of a large firm like I am currently, you know, AECOM, we have our own, you know, diversity and outreach efforts that we're working on, including reaching out to HBCUs and other NOMA members, you know, across our national network to really promote summer camps and internship and actual job opportunities for architects, engineers, and designers of color. Also, you know, project managers, as you know, AECOM's a vast company. There's literally a job that practically anyone could do, you know, if you're not necessarily an architect or engineer. We have a financial analyst, a risk analyst, et cetera. So really just working to reach those groups where there are clusters of burgeoning minority professionals and creating a pipeline that they can have access to opportunities that they might not be aware of due to any types of circumstances that they're going through. Another thing that I would say is just kind of being present and, you know, starting to be a bit more visible, vocal, and active just in general with your profession and what you're doing personally. You know, as an architect, I'm sure, Talisha, you can relate to really like hunkering down and, you know, studying for those ARE exams to get your architectural license. And, you know, honestly, except for, you know, going to work every day, you know, so that I could pay for those exams, I had a bit of a blackout period, as I know many architects do. There are the unicorns that are able to, you know, do it all at the same time, but that's not me in my process or journey. So now that I'm getting these opportunities through leadership roles, such as through NYCOBA and through AECOM, really, which are driven by my purpose to help others, but, you know, these opportunities to, you know, speak out a bit more really just kind of help you to kind of influence others that may be taking notice onto the great work that you have been doing and continue to do. For example, I think last month it was, I gave just a quick 15-minute speech to fifth graders at the elementary school where I went for fifth grade, which was nice for a short little career day. Of course, that was via Zoom during the pandemic. And I have, you know, friends, and even like older family friends and things of that nature who have nieces, nephews, or children of friends, you know, that might be interested in architecture. So them simply, you know, informally reaching out to me, I'm able to say, yes, absolutely. I'd love to speak with them, expose them to a little bit more, so that especially exposing them to the world of Black and minority architects. Because when you're in grade school, you don't necessarily see that. I know with NYCOBA NOMA, as a part of our larger national NOMA initiative, we have Project Pipeline, which is a great program to go into these schools for children as young as like, you know, third grade throughout high school to do activities or summer camps, really just exposing them to the world of design and a potential, you know, career path. And I'll tell you, you know, from the Project Pipelines that I've done in the past, you would be surprised at how astute and aware even children as young as the third grade are, you know, about the world around them and their observations and their thoughts on how the world could be a better place through architecture or design.
I wholeheartedly agree. For anybody who doesn't know about NYCOBA NOMA's Project Pipeline, you should really check it out. That's how I first met you a few years back, Allison. So that's an excellent program. And Rodney, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you feel like we can expand our reach to underserved communities in terms of STEAM professions or the political world? Advocacy.
So there's a lot. By the way, I was a member of NESB. NESB was great. NESB literally was, I think, that organization that got my foot in the door, because a lot of these organizations have these big conferences and invite number of college students to come and intern and kind of see what's out there and get a chance to interview, get a summer internship, and hopefully get an offer after graduating. I think that's huge. Like, that's the big thing in terms of once you're in college and so forth. But in terms of like outreach and trying to get the kids at a young age, it's a lot of work. As you know, it's very few underrepresented minorities. So I'm talking about Black and Latinos who get exposed to the engineering, the science programs. And I know I've had a long conversation with the Chancellor Banks, as well as some of the leadership members of Mayor Eric Adams, and how we can incorporate the workforce aspect into the schools program. So we have a pipeline to a career versus prison, getting a lot of these students internship programs, getting them exposed to different projects. Because math and science doesn't have to be boring. The way it's taught and presented to many of our students probably need a change, a different way of teaching, and should have applications. And I'm sure things have changed since I was in school many years ago, but we still are lacking minorities in this field. And when I say minorities, I'm talking about Black and Latino in particular. I think we have other minority groups that are doing well. We are putting legislation to incentivize underrepresented groups to get more resources in the schools, to get access to internships, externships, programming. And we typically do a grassroots outreach, like churches. Being, you go to church, I know a lot of pastors as an elected official. I communicate with the pastors across the neighborhood. I send out newsletters and let people know these type of programs exist. We recruit sometimes when there's a program that's in need of recruiting. We recruit people. I'm currently in law school, and there's not enough Blacks in my law school program. I don't know if there's just people who are not interested or people who just don't know, but all these law schools, and I just given that example, are still looking for underrepresented qualified students who are interested in coming into their program. So I think a lot of it has to do with outreach as well. You know, I battle with constitutional discrimination issues when I deal with minority women business enterprise. Now we come up with a law and we say you need 30%. Where, you know, the state is in the courts. This is discrimination, reverse discrimination. Usually the majority, like white male run companies, don't want to share. They don't want to share the pie, the economic pie, which should be open to everyone. And because of years and years of discrimination, exclusivity, it's taking some time for, you know, like minority and women-owned businesses to get access to things that will help them win these contracts. You know, just, I mean, like access to capital, that's a big thing. And the discriminatory practices in the banks for many years have, again, kept a group of people from advancing. And so one of the reasons why I'm in law school and really enjoy constitutional law is around those socio and economic justice around, you know, minority women, business enterprise, getting access and not having to fight this reverse racism battle all the time, but also the schools. A lot of the cases are with Black children who get accepted to some of these schools, and sometimes they were referred as set asides or whatever, they would get challenged in the courts because people felt that a Black child getting into a top school, an Ivy League school, they're getting it in a way that's unfair, affirmative action. And they would challenge that to say, this was favoritism, you know, lower threshold and so forth. Mind you, for years and years, a lot of wealthy children have had access to a lot of things, not by merit, but by access because of money. Nepotism, legacy, whatever. And those were never challenged in the courts. So when we think about opportunities for all these kids and to STEAM and so forth, it's a comprehensive effort in terms of not only outreach through community organizations and churches, but also implementing policies and legislation that forces access to these kids in our schools, our public school system. 67% of the children there are Black and Latino kids. Most of these schools do not have enrichment programs. They don't have programs that will allow them to have some type of exposure, STEM, STEAM, internship. A lot of people fight to go to the specialized high school. But again, you think about the truth, you know, who are going to the specialized high school? Stuyvesant, as you know, there's a report every year on how many Black children get into the specialized high school. Seven Blacks got into Stuyvesant this year, 7 or 8. It just tells you the systematic racism is instituted that's preventing a more equitable way and access for Black and brown kids to get resources. There's a law in the state legislature that's called the Heck-Calendra Act, which was put in place in 1971, which in order for you to get into these schools, you got to take this stupid test. This test that lots of communities spend money forcing their kids on Saturday programs to learn how to take has nothing to do with what you and I are doing as engineers and architects and things of that nature. It's a stupid test that just measure how well you can do it to get into these schools. So I'm just showing you all these different barriers that has been put in place to STEAM and STEM, education, economic, wealth, owning a home, all of this stuff. And, you know, the way we change is not only through outreach, but through legislation, making it law, making it like, hey, we have to remedy this. We have to put programs in place, especially in areas that are underserved, schools that's been traditionally separate and unequal, segregated. We have to put programs so that these kids have an opportunity to compete in the world. So it's a lot of work. You know, we're working, like I said, I'm working with Chancellor Banks and making sure that he listens to some of the proposals, getting back some of the enrichment programs in the schools, having workforce development as part of the curriculum, things of that nature.
I think we can all agree that it can be a lot. There can be a lot of barriers. And one of the most important parts that we can do as leaders is to try to get our information out to as many corners of where we live and start with our own local communities, you know, start to get the information out about, you know what, you can go to law school. You can be an architect. And maybe that's one of the most important things that we can do is to reach back and make sure that the future of our professions are getting this information. You did mention, Radnice, that you're in law school, and I don't know how you do all the things you do. I'm sure sleep is not very much in the equation, but you know, you probably take naps and not real full sleep. You know, in hearing you talk and hearing both of you speak, I was just thinking about all the discrimination and the microaggressions and the aggression and just in general, all the weathering that we might have had to go through and continue to go through within our careers and all these barriers to entry to lots of different places, even a local high school that should be competitive. And we have to go through these things alongside actually doing the work, you know, like sometimes when I sit back, I think, oh, wow, you know, it's so much to go through. And I think that that's another reason why we maybe have a lack of people of color, and especially in the Black and Latino community, that we do see in the spaces that we find ourselves in, because it can be very difficult. So I want you to talk a little bit about how you take care of your health and wellness. And I know that that's been a big theme at Nicoba Noma for the past couple of years. And Radnice, this is something that you have definitely taken on as something that's big for you, especially Black maternal health, amongst all the other things. So how do you two take a better care of your health and wellness with the busy schedules that you have? Alice, well, Radnice, you start.
Well, it is tough. And one of the things, again, before my mother passed, you know, my mom said, you got to take care of yourself. And I tried to as much as I can. I was a victim of Black maternal issue. I had lost my son almost 6 years ago, discriminated, pushed out of a hospital, baby coming out, 3 centimeters dilation because of insurance. They didn't want to take me in. And I had one of the best insurance, by the way. But they didn't want to take me in. They're like, oh, go home, go to a local hospital, whatever. You know, my friends took me to a different hospital, had my baby. Baby died, almost died myself. You know, obviously that was a wellness thing as well. But I introduced the bill and passed in my son's name that hospitals cannot push any expectant mothers out, even if they're if they're experiencing preterm labor issues. So that was a bill. We got it out and so forth. That was a life experiencing moment for me in terms of, you know, being able to advocate for other women, being able to take care of myself, taking time out to know that if I'm not healthy or if I'm not well, I cannot serve in my most capacity. And so I do a lot. And I just realized that I probably do more than most people. I do go to bed. I do go to sleep, but I do read in the middle of the night sometimes. I read 2 cases this morning, 6 o'clock in the morning in my bed while my husband is taking a shower. He doesn't know that I'm reading, but I do that. But I also know there's a limit. I can't do everything. I don't want to burn myself out. I want to stay healthy. I want to stay healthy to potentially be a mother in the future. I want to stay healthy to help my community and be well and lead and help younger folks take on the role. So it's very important to take care of yourself. It's very important. Having to take care of my mom, I watched her. It was very difficult all these years having to go back and forth to the hospital and dealing with insurance and bureaucracy and just all this stuff. You have to take care of yourself, you know, don't smoke, eat well, do a little bit of exercise. I try to fit in exercise 3 times a week. I haven't done so in 2 months, but so I gained 10 pounds. But, you know, when you get all back on track, you know, you do your exercise, you move your joints, you walk, you exercise your heart. That's very, very important, especially as you get older. So for me, wellness is very important, sanity. I am in a role where every day I have to deal with some political issue, some community issue, something. It's like crisis every day. And then I have to take time to try to study and then take time to spend time with my husband. It's very difficult, but you have to master it somehow, some way. And I was telling Talisha, I was texting her, my place is being renovated, right? So I'm dealing with that also, doing all of this while being a little bit displaced. So we just have to find a way. But Black women, women in general, I'll say it's a women thing. We find a way to know how to juggle all these things and come out okay.
For sure, for sure. I've heard other people say that you're just not going to be good at everything every single day. One day you might be a better wife than you are a law student, you know? And the next day you're going to be a better assemblywoman than you are a wife. But, you know, all in all, it'll all balance itself out if you pay attention to what's at hand. So Allison, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you take care of your health and wellness?
Sure. I mean, I can absolutely relate to Rodney's a bit and her going back to school, being in law school right now, while also working as an assemblywoman and all of the other wonderful initiatives that you work on. After I went to undergrad at UPenn for my undergraduate degree in architecture, and then I decided to start working to get some professional experience before going back to get my master's in architecture. So I took a bit of a break. And then when I decided to finally go back for my master's, I was so used to working and I enjoyed the work that I was doing. I decided to do both, so work and go to school and, you know, do that master's in architecture with all the studios and other courses. You know, at the same time, it was definitely my greatest lesson in time management, which, you know, I figure if I survive that, you know, anything that I'm doing now as it relates to advancement in my career and also working with organizations such as Nykuba Noma, you know, that's nothing now. Like, I can definitely handle it. And, you know, like Talisha said, you know, you might not be the best at, you know, everything all the time. So some days you have to pick and choose your battles and, you know, really also learn how to prioritize pretty much on a daily basis. You know, some people have like a calendar with a monthly and weekly outlook. You know, I have like a daily outlook that's broken down literally by hours. It helps me to stay organized a bit and, you know, really just try not to beat myself up too much. I'm probably my hardest critic. So really just trying to stay on top of health and wellness. I'll be the first to say that I'm not consistent on a daily basis, but, you know, I do try to eat balanced meals with, you know, a lot of vegetables, as well as work out, you know, at least 4 times a week. But, you know, some days if I don't have that time to work out, you definitely feel that anxiety in your body. So, you know, sometimes I go on a short walk. Other times I do jumping jacks. I think I read an article, you know, just doing like 20 jumping jacks will help quell your anxiety a little bit. So really just, you know, trying to be mindful while focusing on mindfulness, but also visualization and meditation are other techniques that I try to employ just to help me focus on certain tasks at hand, when I'm doing it and when I need to do it, just to try to stay on top of my constant to-do list. Lastly, I would say on that note, just thinking about the community aspect, you know, of the work that I'm doing professionally and with regard to extracurricular and organizational work that I'm doing really helps me to push through. And, you know, another synergy with Rodney's and, you know, all of her public work that she's doing. I'm currently working as a consultant with NYCHA through a program in AECOM that I'm working on as one of the design project managers. So we're seeking to put forth some updates and modernization efforts for NYCHA in the coming years, which is truly exciting. Deep diving into, you know, work with a public client, you know, has its challenges as opposed to, you know, challenges with private clients, simply just because you're dealing with, you know, an abundance of stakeholders and you want to do right by the tenants and by the community and, you know, as well as pushing forth, you know, advancement, innovation. But I think just staying connected to what I see as my purpose and roles that I take on in terms of seeking to help others, you know, helps me stay focused and a bit calm when I might seemingly be in the midst of a storm or a challenge.
That's all very good and good information to share with people so that they can think of little ways. I was just in a workshop or a seminar about mental health and the environment. And one of the things that I got from that, which I get from what both of you are saying, is that you should do one little thing, even if it's one little thing that you can do every day for yourself in order to sort of break out of whatever it is that you're doing, even if it's 20 jumping jacks, you know, you know, it's a little way of you getting out of the rut. So then I'll start with you, Rodney's. Who was maybe like one of your biggest mentors and where do you see yourself going in the future of your career?
Aside from my mother, because I think all mothers are everybody's mentors, I would say the two people who gave me a start in life, as mentioned before, one is Dr. Stephanie Goldberg, who's the only female woman in the technology program at Buffalo State, who encouraged me to take on this path. She is a Jewish woman, LGBT, phenomenal. Without her, I would not be here in terms of my career. And the other person I would say was my first supervisor, which was a Black woman in Lucent Technologies. Her name is Waverly Hegyesby. And again, these are foundational mentors because she instilled in me that, you know, go back to school, you know, get your master's, you're going to be challenged in life, make sure you have all your P's and Q's. And she encouraged me, you know, again, to go to master's to get promoted. She's been a good friend since then, but she really, really opened my eyes in terms of like corporate America and having to work alongside of men and how I was treated very different and how I had to bypass that. Really encouraged me, gave me a lot of strength. So I think I owe my foundation to these two women, Dr. Goldberg and Waverly Hegyesby. And from then on, I've met other mentors who were gracious, like Assemblywoman Annette Robinson in the Assembly, Attorney General Tish James. You know, women like them have been awesome to me in my political journey. So very thankful for these women. Where do I see myself? I don't know. I would like to see myself practicing law in the courts. I really enjoy constitutional law, as mentioned, representing folks, in hoping to see where that take me. And we'll see. I know people say, oh, are you going to run for mayor? Governor, I'm not looking at that. I'm looking at loving my life, having a stable and sane life with my family, having some normalcy. Again, practicing law. I think that would be cool.
Do you prefer pancakes or waffles?
Waffles. I like the squares.
Cake or pie?
Pie.
Pie. Oh, okay.
I like the triangles.
Okay, okay. Are horoscopes BS or fascinating?
Fascinating. No. I'm all about horoscopes.
Every day here, every morning. Meditate, read my horoscope. So yes. Do you like pineapple or no pineapple on your pizza? This one is a controversial one. So
it depends. So if it's a traditional New York pizza, I'd rather the like greasy, real Italian flat pizza with just nothing. But if I'm in Chicago and I have their pizza, I wouldn't mind pineapple.
Okay. You see, you're a real politician because you answered that the best that I've ever heard. Is a hot dog a sandwich?
No way. It's hot dog.
And last but not least, do you say pecan or pecan?
Pecan.
Okay.
Who says pecan?
Well, you never know. Maybe some people in the room. Not me, but Allison, why don't you tell me who some of your biggest mentors were along your career and what you want for your career going into the future?
I would say that, in addition to my parents being foremost mentors, along with my grandparents, other people, that I've admired along the way and have given me advice include, I would say Malcolm McLaren. He's a engineer of McLaren Engineering in New York. And he's the father of one of my best friends from high school. And he really was excited when this young Black girl was like, I'm going to be an architect when I grow up. So he was able to introduce me to other architects and engineers and really, support me along the way, just encourage me, give me any advice, whether I was printing out early portfolios in his office, for interviews and things like that, structural advice as well. Also, one of my mom's best friends, Dana Green-Stilley, she always encouraged me as another Black female that went to an Ivy League school. So she was always a source of inspiration and mentorship. I'd also say my siblings, especially my two sisters, Ashley and Alex. On a fun note, siblings, we always go at each other, but, they've been some of my best supporters often, always challenging me to do even more, as siblings do. And then I'd also say, as it relates to, fellow Black architects, that I've come to know through getting involved with Nykuba Noma, I would definitely say, Greg Schweitzer, our current Nykuba Noma president, as well as Talisha. And, all the work that you've done in the offices that you've held as well in Nykuba Noma and, everything that you're doing now as the president of AIA Brooklyn, which is super exciting. And, just another shout out to Nykuba Noma is that, it allows me to connect with fellow Black architects and architects of color, as I didn't know any Black architects growing up personally. I know people in other fields, related to architecture. Yes, new Black architects. And then I would say definitely a lot of people at the firms that I've worked at over the various years, starting from internships, then working at Stephen B. Jacobs Group, as well as ACOM, some of my immediate colleagues, such as Jeff Lynch and Kim Verhuggle, as well as Roxana Karolingas, who's been an excellent supporter and mentor in terms of just project management at such a large scale, which has enabled me to perform on some great projects at AECOM, including my current work with NYCHA. And then the other question, I believe, was, where do I see myself in the coming years. I think definitely, you know, I want to achieve that work-life balance with an eventual family, but also continuing to work in my field and hopefully trailblaze a little bit more and just continue to connect with other people, you know, such as yourself and Assemblywoman Rodnice, and, you know, really seeking out a principal position at a firm, you know, whether it's my current firm, another firm, my own firm, you know, in the future, who knows what that holds. And really just lastly, as I attempt to create that balanced life for myself, which can sometimes have its moments out of whack, I really want to continue to make sure that the work that I am doing professionally and personally, you know, really does affect the lives of others, you know, whether it's through housing or, you know, public spaces and opportunities and so on and so forth. So really just continuing to keep the idea of community building and community enhancement and equitable design at, you know, one of the center points of everything that I'm doing and attempting to build upon.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you're already on the right track, I'm sure. I'm sure of it in getting there. So now I want to ask you some of the fun questions. Do you prefer pancakes or waffles?
I would say waffles, unless there are Cracker Barrel pancakes.
Are those your favorite?
Yeah, those are my favorite. Those are the best pancakes ever.
Yeah, you know, fun fact or sad fact, I don't know. I've never been to Cracker Barrel to eat.
I mean, those are my, you know, Southern Georgia.
Yeah, right? Sure. Yeah.
There's one maybe like 3 hours north of the city, somewhere in New York.
Of this city?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Like upstate, yeah.
I've seen Cracker Barrels on my way to Albany or on my way other places, but never actually went into one. That's also on the bucket list. Japan, Cracker Barrel. You know, it makes sense, right? Cake or pie?
I'd say pie. Grandmother and mother make a great sweet potato pie.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. All right. Do you think horoscopes are BS or fascinating?
I think fascinating.
Pineapple or no pineapple on your pizza?
Oh, no pineapple. I like to keep things separate sometimes in terms of food.
So just ever, no pineapple.
No pineapple on pizza, pineapple by itself or pineapple upside down cake, sure.
No pineapple on your pizza ever.
No.
Is a hot dog a sandwich?
No.
Okay. Pecan or pecan?
Pecan, again, Southern roots, pecan pie, Georgia.
Well, Rodnice, thank you very much for being here with us. You know, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us and for us learning a little bit more about what you do. And when I say what you do, I mean all that you do. I find you to be amazing and I'm in awe of you every single time that I see your face on the news, in my newsletter that I get every day. So thank you for all that you do, especially being one of your constituents. I really appreciate what you do.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Talisha, for having me. Thank you. Thank you, AIA, the organization, the podcast. And thank Allison for also sharing your experience. I learned a lot. Enjoyed being on the show with you. And Talisha, thank you for your leadership. This has been great. I look forward to potentially being back on again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thank you, Allison, for taking the time to be here today as well. We really appreciate hearing more about you. And I know I personally am looking forward to seeing you continue on, especially when you become president of Nykoba Noma. I'm so thrilled that you are in this position and I'm looking forward to everything that you'll do inside of Nykoba Noma and outside, you know, because I'm going to be watching your career and now you can't get rid of me. So
that's so, so amazing. Like, I really, you know, appreciate you nudging me to do the podcast. It's been a wonderful experience and opportunity. So thank you, Talisha, you know, for your support throughout, you know, the process of working with Nykoba Noma and becoming the president-elect. I cannot thank you enough for your tremendous support. And I look forward to continuing to work with you. And again, thank you to the AIA, as well as Robin and Kara for your support and help in this process as well. It's been a wonderful conversation with both you, Talisha, and Assemblywoman Rodney as well.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.